Welcome to The Program, a podcast dedicated to exposing the institutional child abuse that occurred at the hands of WASP, or Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, an organization that owned a network of dozens of schools that systemically abused at-risk teens and exploited their parents for millions of dollars. This podcast aims to expose those responsible and seek justice for the damage caused to the innocent children who endured unspeakable abuse. This podcast is for the survivors. I dedicate this to you. Welcome back to the program. This is your host, Caroline Lorson, and in today's episode, I'm going to share with you the history, the controversy, and the demise of WASP specialty program, the Academy at Ivy Ridge. This is the program that I attended for 29 months, so I'm even more excited to speak on it. But first, I want to deeply express my gratitude to all of the people who've been sharing our stories and speaking out against WASP. In private conversations, I see the deep healing that it's bringing to the people who attended these programs. Seriously, you guys have no idea how much that means to us. You have to understand how isolated we were from the world. And many times during my stay at the Academy at Ivy Ridge, I thought to myself, if people only knew what was happening here, right? If people only knew what was happening. I thought that so many times. I knew people would be outraged. And now people do know. And it's been so incredibly validating. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you so much. We've actually started a GoFundMe to help us take further action in shutting down these places and also to seek justice for the survivors. The fund will be overseen by an advisory board so we can assure that the money is allocated in an effective way to move forward with meaning. So if you're asking, what can I do to help? This would be a fantastic way. Even a dollar or $5 helps tremendously in the grand scheme of things. So if it is on your heart to contribute, I will include the GoFundMe link in the description of the episode below. Also, if you are listening to the episode, check this out. I think this is awesome. You guys can leave us voice notes on what you think. So as you're listening, if you're listening within the Anchor app, there's a little button that you will see that says message, and you can click that to leave us a voice message. So tap that button. It will let you record a voice message and then listen in on the next episode to hear your spotlight, right? I will be spotlighting all of the people who choose to leave us voice notes because we want to hear from the people what you're thinking as you're listening to this crazy shit, okay? So again, just thank you to everyone supporting our mission and even those that aren't and feel like we got what we deserved. You're only furthering our point. So thank you to you two. So let's dive in to the good old Academy at Ivy Ridge. The Academy at Ivy Ridge was purchased by Robert Browning Litchfield Family Limited of Tokerville, Utah in 2001. The school is the old Matter Day College located on 237 acres in the rural, isolated town of Ogdensburg, New York. The closest major city to Ogdensburg is Syracuse, which is 128 miles southwest of the school. Later, it would be noted by the Attorney General of New York, Elliot Spitzer, that the ownership of the school was comprised of two entities, the Jason G. Fenlinson Corporation and the Joseph and Alan Mitchell Corporation. Both these entities were created for the sole purpose of operations at the Academy at Ivy Ridge. The Academy at Ivy Ridge was run by the director, Jason Finlinson, who was the son-in-law of Robert Litchfield. You'll see that just about every WASP program was run by some kind of relative of WASP creator Robert Litchfield. Jason Finlinson was once the director of WASP program in Mexico, Casa by the Sea, until he was moved to New York with his wife, Maybeth Finlinson, Litchfield's daughter, to open the Academy at Ivy Ridge in 2001. According to Finlinson's Facebook page, he claims that he studied at Utah Valley University in the early 90s, but does not specify if he earned a degree, and to our knowledge has no education in child development, psychology, or any kind of qualifications to provide treatment. The Academy at Ivy Ridge relied on online advertising and partnership with Teen Help LLC and the other WASP marketing wings. They had several different groups that would go out and they would market online. They had 1-800 hotline numbers. And so this is how it all happened, okay? This is what is tricky about these agencies, is that they seemed like they were independent referral services, like they had nothing to do with WASP, right? They marketed themselves as free resources for parents. So let's say you're a parent in the late 90s, early 2000s, and you sit down and you're searching online for things like help for my teen or teen behavior issues or my teen's out of control, right? Like any of that stuff. And some of the first options that are going to pop up in that search were links to Teen Help and their other offshoots. Thinking that these were independent referral services, I think it would be safe to assume that parents believed these agencies would share any and all resources, but they didn't. Their sole function was to get kids to these WASP programs. Regardless of the teen, regardless of their needs or psychiatric conditions, they would be recommended to one of the WASP schools. In fact, at Robert Litchfield's first facility, the Brightway Adolescent Hospital, a center where they screened teenagers and referred them to services, authorities found template assessment letters where every single child would receive the exact same diagnosis and the exact same referral, which of course was to one of the WASP schools. Brightway then closed down, but Litchfield and his cronies continued the same method of practice with their other WASP facilities. So with all of these groups working to funnel kids into the WASP programs, it didn't take very long, and Finlinson was able to draw students into the Academy at Ivy Ridge. But keep in mind, without any credentials, licensing with the state, or advisory agency, the Academy at Ivy Ridge was essentially just some guy who bought a building and said, "Send me your kids." And it worked. The kids arrived. Upon intake at the facility, the children would be strip searched, made to bend over, showing their private parts, and staff would even ask them to squat and cough. Then their belongings would be inventoried, and they were permitted to keep only the very basic necessities. They would be issued Academy at Ivy Ridge uniforms, which for the girls consisted of a white button-up blouse, a navy sweater vest, a long kilt-like plaid skirt, biker shorts, and knee-high socks. And they were required to wear their hair in a braid. The boys wore khaki pants, a white button-down, and an Academy at Ivy Ridge tie. Girls were not allowed to shave, wear makeup, or have any kind of beauty product outside of the most basic dollar store lotion, which was only allowed to be used immediately after showers. Although the school was co-ed, communication or even looking at the opposite sex was strictly prohibited, and they divided the campus into the girls' side and the boys' side. Each side was further divided into groups known as families. Each family had approximately 20 to 30 students, and this was the group that the student would stay with all throughout their daily activities. Each family had one dorm parent and usually an assigned upper level or student who had proven their trust in the facility to assist the dorm parent. Each family was given a name like Success, Wisdom, Hope, Excellence, Faith, Serenity, and the list goes on. These families of students would walk in a military-style line structure, walking only the perimeter of the hallways and within an arm's length distance of the person in front of them. If they broke line structure for any reason, they were given a demerit. So let's talk for a second about the larger structure of the program and what was required of each child to earn their way home. The entire foundation of the system is based on earning points for good behavior while avoiding demerits and gaining levels out of a 6-level system. So when a student arrived at the program, they were considered to be level 1 with 0 points. At the end of each day, students would rate themselves on their behavior, attitude, hygiene, and how they treated their staff and peers. On average, it was possible to earn approximately 12 points per day. Staff would either approve or deny the self-reported points, sometimes leaving students in the negatives. Once a student acquired 200 points, they automatically became a level 2, which essentially meant that they got a candy bar on Sundays. In order to advance to level 3, a student must accumulate 1,000 points and also receive approval from their peers, teachers, student council, their family representative, and upper administration. Each level required various behavior changes like accountability, leadership in the facility, calling out and referring demerits to their peers, and completion of the seminars by Premier Educational Services. More on the seminars. More on the seminars in another episode. We're going to do an entire episode just on the seminars because, well, they deserve it. They deserve their own episode. So we are going to go there, okay? Hang in there with me, you guys. So they had to do all of this in order to prove that they were rehabilitated enough to be working their way home. The academy at Ivy Ridge had a stifling amount of rules, from no talking at any time, no gesturing or facial expressions, no looking out windows, and no borrowing or sharing anything with anyone. Dorm parents and students would constantly refer to the lengthy list of demerits and dish them out all day long at will for any reason that they saw fit. So we're going to get into the demerits. I want you guys to understand this because I want you to understand how oppressive it was at the time. Okay. So we're going to get into the structure of the demerits and what that looked like and what that experience was like. Okay. This is so essential in really fully understanding what this program experience was. So demerits also had many levels. There was category 1. 2, 3, 4, and 5. A category 1 demerit would cost you 5 points. And keep in mind, as we're going through this, you can only earn 12 points a day, around in there. Okay. Only 12 points a day. So a category 1 demerit could cost you 5 points and could be given for things like bad posture, being even a second late to lineup, or anything that they felt was unsatisfactory. So that is 5 points. Category 1 is 5 points. A category 2 demerit would cost you 25 points. So that's 2 days. Okay. Keep that in mind. A category 2 demerit could cost you 25 points and could be given for things like leaving your water bottle somewhere, talking without permission, even just making a noise like a grunt could be considered communication. Yeah, a grunt. Or not following directions precisely. A Category 3 demerit would cost you 50 points and could be given for things like lending some shampoo to a friend, having a negative attitude, or any kind of blatant rule violation. Then Category 4 and Category 5 corrections or demerits, they're the big ones, the ones you definitely didn't want to get. If you got a Category 4 demerit, you lost 2 levels and all of your points. When I first got to the facility, looking out the window, glancing out the window was considered a Category 4 run plans because they thought that we may be looking out the window to try and run away. Then a Category 5 demerit would cause you to lose all of your points and all of your levels and essentially start your program all over. Category 5 demerits were for things like self-infliction and drugs and alcohol. But the program had a funny way of twisting these demerits. Popping a pimple, okay? I pop pimples. I got a problem. I like to pop my pimples, okay? So popping pimples was considered self-infliction. Or if you ate too much and you made yourself sick, that was considered self-infliction. Category 5 demerit, and you would start all over again, no matter how long you'd been there. And staff would frequently do things like stack demerits. So let me give you an example. Let's say I forgot my water bottle in another room. The staff might say, "Caroline, you forgot your water bottle. You have a Category 203, disrespect to property." There's 25 points gone. Over 2 days worth of points. Then maybe I would say, "What?" Then the staff might say, "And now you have an unauthorized communication and a disrespect to staff." That's 50 more points gone. So feeling flustered and shut down and frustrated, my emotions might get the best of me and I might shout out, "I hate this place. I don't want to do this." Then the staff would tack on, "Now you have a Category 4 refusal." So what started as a water bottle being left in another room ended up costing me all of my points and 2 of my levels. This is how people snapped. This is when people lost it. And then they would be physically restrained. Staff could give demerits for anything that they felt like, whether it was a rule or not, and there was very little, if anything, that we could do. Staff frequently used stacking demerits to test the teens and push them towards that emotional brink of losing it. Some staff would issue demerits to entire families for really anything that they saw fit. If they were having a bad day, we got more corrections, and we definitely knew the staff who delighted in giving large demerits to entire hallways of students. They truly delighted in the power and control, and our lack of ability to have any kind of recourse. Let's say you didn't have enough points to cover a demerit. Let's say you have 20 points, but you receive a 25-point demerit. You would go to study hall. Study hall was a small, musty room with lines of desks and one dorm parent sitting at the head of the room. Students were required to sit in structure with their feet together on the floor, knees no more than a fist's width apart, and their backs straight no more than 3 inches from the back of the seat, and they would copy the rule book or textbooks margin to margin on a lined sheet of paper until their time in study hall was up. In study hall, students were required to participate in study hall fitness every 2 hours, which was particularly grueling and challenging. They definitely wanted you to know that it was a punishment. This also created opportunity for students to acquire more demerits if staff deemed their efforts unsatisfactory, which would lengthen their stay in study hall. Personally, I spent a hell of a lot of time in study hall. So once a student reached level 4 and up, they were no longer required to walk in line with the family, and they had greater responsibility to assist the dorm parents and essentially act as staff. But as an upper level, you were not allowed to receive any Category 3 or higher demerits. If you did, they would put you on what they called probation, and you would go back to walking in line structure with your family. One time when I was an upper level, staff performed room searches and they found that my initials had worn off of the tape on my hairbrush. You could see where it had been, but at the time, it was not legible. They considered this to be an illegal item, and I was placed on probation in my family, and it tacked on about another month to my program. What we know now is that the family representatives, a position that only required a high school diploma, who were staff that was assigned to each family and was responsible for communicating with our biological families, they actually strategically targeted students whose parents had money and whose parents wanted them to graduate. They would concoct situations for the student to receive demerits with the help of other staff. And these demerits would cause that student to go on probation because, get this, these family representatives made commission on each student. So guess what? The longer that you're there, the more money that they're making. So the very staff that was supposed to be helping us get home was actually making commission the longer that we stayed. I also have documentation that any time a parent would talk about removing their child from the program, the family representatives were told to write a red flag report with 3 to 5 red flags showing that the student was not ready and therefore keeping them in the program longer. Family representatives were also instructed to pressure families through financial difficulties. So if a parent expressed that they couldn't afford the school anymore, the family rep was specifically told to say, "If you had a loved one with a terminal illness, wouldn't you do anything in your power?" Then they would refer them to a loan company, Optimum Billing. And can you guess who Optimum Billing is owned by? You guessed it, WASP. And if a family, oh my gosh, you guys, sometimes it's just too much. I won't lie, I swear. It's just like, how crazy can this get? It's wild. So here we go. So if a family rep's family dropped below 18 students, they were reprimanded and fined. So between commission and fines, they had a lot of incentive to do anything in their power to keep students there. Many students have reported family representatives feeding false information to their parents in an attempt to keep them there longer. One of the biggest hurdles in revealing the treatment at this school was censorship of all incoming and outgoing mail. And this was done through the family reps as well, by the way. If a student complained, staff would advise that that student was manipulating and lying, and they would redact the letters or not send them at all. Once a student earned a phone call with parents, which on average was around the 12-month mark, the family representative would sit within earshot, only a couple feet from the student, and would interject if the conversation started steering to discussion of mistreatment. Complaining or reporting anything that went on within the program was highly discouraged. They created a culture where if you complained, it showed that you weren't ready to go home yet. So eventually, the children just stopped trying to speak out against the program in any form. I mean, after all, it would only keep you there longer. As you can imagine, being under this extreme amount of pressure, on top of the physical trauma of being restrained and watching peers be thrown around and restrained, there's many students who wanted to run away, and some tried. Students were instructed, listen to this, students were instructed to stop runaways by any means possible, including tackling them and breaking their legs. Word for word, you guys, we were told to break their fucking legs. Staff also touted that locals would see our uniforms and shoot us without a second thought. They also went on to explain that the thick woods around us had aggressive turkey vultures and wild hogs that were sure to attack us on sight. So, if you were able to escape through the maze of magnetically sealed doors that partitioned the entire campus, the hordes of students chasing after you, hungry for some leg breaking, and the gun-wielding, sharp-shooting neighbors, you most certainly would be eaten by the beasts living in the woods. That was the world we lived in. In February of 2005, the activities at the Academy at Ivy Ridge caught the attention of the New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer on allegations of physical abuse. State officials subpoenaed the Academy to find out exactly what kind of institution it was. At the time, the president of WASP, Ken Kay, spoke out on the investigation and said, "What it looks like to me is it's really nice to know the state of New York and the people involved in the state of New York take these things seriously," he said. "It's nice to know that, hey, those guys are doing their job." Mr. K also said he hoped the state investigators would keep in mind that the students at Ivy Ridge are egregious teens who make up stories and manipulate people to get their way. So I'm going to give you guys a little insider scoop on how this all went down. I remember it very vividly. As soon as contact was made from the state attorney general's office, administration at Ivy Ridge scrambled. They started changing minor rules to make it seem like we had more freedom. They started taking us outside. They made a boys' basketball team. And above all, they started training staff on how to restrain students, where before that, they absolutely had no training. Each staff had a little binder with their trainings that walked them through on basic restraint protocol, you know, like don't slam them on the fucking ground, don't choke them, hit them, etc. I clearly remember staff rushing to get their trainings done. The pressure was on. But even despite all the fucked upness of this school, at least there was one silver lining. You could get ahead in your studies and graduate high school early, right? Wrong. At the same time that the attorney general was investigating the school on allegations of abuse, they started looking into the Academy at Ivy Ridge's accreditation and their legal status to be issuing high school diplomas. The attorney general's office felt that the school was actually a behavior modification facility and not a school at all. Up until this point, the academy advertised that it was accredited by the Northwest Association of Accredited Schools in Boise, Idaho, when in fact they were just a candidate for accreditation. But considering that in order to be accredited, the school must be registered, certificated, or licensed in the state where it resides, the academy was actually never a candidate to begin with. So let me repeat for emphasis. The academy at Ivy Ridge was unaccredited and not registered, certified, or licensed by anyone. Eventually, the Academy at Ivy Ridge was ordered to pay $250,000 in fines for issuing fake diplomas, and they returned 1 month of tuition to each parent. However, this did very little to support the students who earned an education at this school. Most students had issues transferring credits, and even I was asked to redo the 10th grade after attempting to continue my education in a public school. The New York State attorneys said Ivy Ridge was behind one of the largest educational fraud cases in the history of the state. This is so incredibly dangerous, you guys. Seriously, take this in for a second. This was a man who bought a building in New York and with absolutely no oversight brought in up to 500 children at a time into his behavior modification program. When there's no oversight, this means that the practices within this school didn't have to meet any type of criteria or therapeutic standard. They were doing whatever the fuck they wanted. And when something happened at this school, who do you report it to? Who answers for this school? No one. Even in seeking legal recourse, one of the biggest hiccups in past cases is identifying who should have been overseeing these residential facilities. In other psychiatric centers or group homes, it's typically a combination of the State Department of Health or State Department of Mental Health. But in this situation, considering the school was completely unlicensed and therefore not held accountable for its practices or abuse, it's horrid, and someone has to answer for this. The staff relied on painting this picture of a bunch of rowdy, untrustworthy kids who were manipulative liars, despite being on 24 hours of silence a day. This silenced us even further. After a dramatic drop in attendance, the Academy at Ivy Ridge shut its doors in 2009. After 8 years of illegal operation, now you have a good foundational knowledge about the Academy at Ivy Ridge. In the next episode, I'm bringing on the survivors. I want you to hear directly from them the accounts of mental, emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, medical neglect, and the after effects of brainwashing and distress. We'll also be going deep on the seminars, the riot, and what happens after you spend any length of time in an institution like this. I look forward to giving you guys real life accounts of what it was like. Thank you so much for supporting us. Seeing the public flock to our stories has been one of the most healing parts of this journey, and there's still so much to share, like so much, right? This is just the foundation of what you need to know in order to understand the rest of it. So if you were moved by what you heard today, I ask you to please support us by sharing this podcast, leaving a review, leaving a rating. And if it is in your heart, you can make a donation to our GoFundMe page where we are raising money to seek justice against these organizations and the individuals who profited and benefited from the institutional abuse of children. You can find the link to our GoFundMe page in the description of this podcast. Every little bit helps, seriously. Even a dollar pushes us that much closer to achieving justice. Thank you again. This is Caroline Lorson. See you next time.